The 33 sermons on Nibbana were delivered by the Venerable Bhikkhu Katukurunde Nyanananda in Sinhala at Mitrigala Nisaranavinaya Forest Hermitage. They were translated into English by the same Venerable Monk, presently residing at Potkulkala Forest Hermitage in Kandagedra Devalagam.
තස් භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස නමෝ තස් භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස නමෝ තස් භගවතු අරහතෝ සම්මා සම්බුද්ධස්ස ඒතං සන්තං ඒතං පනිතං යදිදං සබ්බ සංඛාර සමතෝ සබ්බෝපති පටිනිසග්ගෝ අන්නක්ඛයෝ විරාගෝ නිරෝධෝ නිබ්බාන. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely, the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the most venerable great preceptor and the assembly of the venerable meditative monks, this is the 18th sermon in the series of sermons on Nibbana. We happened to mention in our last sermon that many of the discourses dealing with the subject of Nibbana have been misinterpreted due to a lack of appreciation of the fact that the transcendence of the world and crossing over to the farther shore of existence have to be understood in a psychological sense. The view that the Arhant at the end of his life enters into an absolutely existing asankhata dhatu or unprepared element seems to have received acceptance in the commentarial period. In the course of our last sermon, we made it clear that some of the discourses cited by the commentators in support of that view deal, on the contrary, with some kind of realization the Arahant goes through here and now in this very life, in this very world, a realization of the cessation of existence or the cessation of the six sense spheres. Even when the Buddha refers to the Arahant as the Brahmin who, having gone beyond, is standing on the farther shore, he was speaking of the Arahant who has realized in this very life the influx-free deliverance of the mind and deliverance through wisdom in his concentration of the fruit of Arahantu. Therefore, on the strength of this evidence, we are compelled to elicit a subtler meaning of the concept of this shore and the farther shore from these discourses dealing with Nibbana than is generally accepted in the world. Our sermon today is specially addressed to that end. As we mentioned before, if one is keen on getting a solution to the problems relating to Nibbana, the discourses we are now taking up for discussion might reveal the deeper dimensions of that problem. We had to wind up our last sermon while drawing out the implications of the last line of the concluding verse in the Paramattaka Sutta of the Suttanipata, Parangato na pachyeti tadi. We drew the inference that the steadfast one, the Arahant, who is such like, once gone to the farther shore, does not come back. We find, however, quite a different idea expressed in a verse of the Nalaka Sutta in the Suttanipata. The verse, which was the subject of much controversy among the ancients, runs as follows. Ucchavachahi patipada samanena pakasita na parang digunang yanti na idang eka gunang muta. High and low are the paths made known by the recluse. They go not twice to the farther shore, nor yet is it to be reckoned a going once. The last two lines seem to contradict each other. There is no going twice to the farther shore, but still it is not to be conceived as a going once. Now, as for the first two lines, the high and low paths refer to the modes of practice adapted according to the grades of understanding in different character types. For instance, the highest grade of persons attain Nibbana by an easy path, being quick-witted, Sukhapatipada Khippabhinna, whereas the lowest grade attain it by a difficult path, being relatively dull-witted, Dukkhapatipada Dandhabhinna. The problem lies in the last two lines. The commentary tries to tackle it by interpreting the reference to not going twice to the farther shore, naparang digunang yanti, as an assertion that there is no possibility of attaining Nibbana by the same path twice. Ekamaggena dikkhattum Nibbanam nayanti. The implication is that the supramundane path of a stream winner, a once returner or a non-returner, arises only once. Why it is not to be conceived as a going once is explained as an acceptance of the norm that requires not less than four supramundane paths to attain arahatthood. However, a deeper analysis of the verse in question would reveal the fact that it effectively brings up an apparent contradiction. The commentary sidetracks by resolving it into two different problems. The two lines simply reflect two aspects of the same problem. They go not twice to the farther shore, and this not going twice, na idam, is however not to be thought of as a going once either. The commentary sidetracks by taking idam, this, to mean the farther shore, param, whereas it comprehends the whole idea of not going twice. Only then is the paradox complete. In other words, this verse concerns the such like one, the arahant, and not the stream winner, once returner, or the non-returner. Here we have an echo of the idea already expressed as the grand finale of the Paramattaka Sutta, Parangato na pachyeti tadi. The such like one, gone to the farther shore, comes not back. It is the last line, however, that remains a puzzle. Why is this not going twice not to be thought of as a going once? There must be something deep behind this riddle. Now, for instance, when one says, I won't go there twice, it means that he will go only once. When one says, I won't tell twice, it follows that he will tell only once. But here we are told that the arahant goes not twice, and yet it is not a going once. The idea behind this riddle is that the influx-free arahant, the such-like one, gone to the farther shore, which is supramundane, does not come back to the mundane. Nevertheless, he apparently comes back to the world and is seen to experience likes and dislikes, pleasures and pains, through the objects of the five senses. From the point of view of the worldling, the arahant has come back to the world. This is the crux of the problem. Why is it not to be conceived of as a going once? Because the arahant has the ability to detach himself from the world from time to time and reattain to that arahatta phala samadhi. It is true that he too experiences the objects of the five external senses, but now and then he brings his mind to dwell in that arahatta phala samadhi, which is like standing on the farther shore. Here then we have an extremely subtle problem. When the arahant comes back to the world and is seen experiencing the objects of the five senses, one might of course conclude that he is actually in the world. This problematic situation, namely the question how the influx-free arahant gone to the farther shore comes back and takes in objects through the senses, the Buddha resolves with the help of a simple simile drawn from nature. For instance, we read in the Jara Sutta of the Sutta Nipata the following scintillating lines. Udabindu yathapi pokkare padume vari yatha nalippati evang muni nopalippati yagdang titthasutam hutesuva. Like the drop of water on the lotus leaf, or water that taints not the lotus petal, so the sage unattached remains in regard to what is seen, heard and sensed. So the extremely deep problem concerning the relation between the supramundane and the mundane levels of experience is resolved by the Buddha by bringing in the simile of the lotus petal and the lotus leaf. Let us take up another instance from the Magandhya Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. Yehi vivittu vicharaya loki natani uggaiha vadaya nago erambujan kantakam varijan yatha jalena pankena anupalittam evam muni santi vado agiddho kameche lokeche anupalitto. Detached from whatever views, the Arahant wanders in the world. He would not converse, taking his stand on them. Even as the white lotus sprung up in the water, yet remains unsmeared by water and mud, so is the sage professing peace and free from greed, unsmeared by pleasures of sense and things of the world. Among the tenets of the Anguttara Nikaya, we come across a discourse in which the Buddha answers a question put by Venerable Bhāhuna. At that time, the Buddha was staying near the pond Gaggara in the city of Champa. Venerable Bhāhuna's question was, Kathi nukho bhante dhammehi tathāgato nisatto visangyutto vipamutto vimariyādhikatena chetsa viharati. Detached, disengaged and released from how many things does the Tathagata dwell with an unrestricted mind? The Buddha's answer to the question embodies a simile aptly taken from the pond, as it were. Dasai kho bahuna dhamme tathagato nisatto visangyutto vipamutto vimariyadikatena chetasa viharati. Katamehi dasai rupena kho bahuna tathagato nisatto visangyutto vipamutto vimariyadikatena chetasa viharati. Vedanaya, sanyaya, sankharehi, vinyanena, jatiya, jaraya, maranena, dukkhehi, kilesehi kho bahuna tathagato nisatto visangyutto vipamutto vimariyadikatena chetasa viharati. Sayathapi bahuna uppalangva, padumangva, pundarikangva, udake jatam, udake sangvaddham, udaka achugam tithati anupalittam udakena, evameva kho bahuna tathagato imehi dasai dhamme nisatto visangyutto vipamutto vimariyadikatena chetasa viharati. Detached, disengaged and released from ten things, bahuna, does the Tathagata dwell with the mind unrestricted? Which ten? Detached, disengaged and released from form, bahuna, does the Tathagata dwell with the mind unrestricted? Detached, disengaged and released from feeling, from perceptions, from preparations, from consciousness, from birth, from decay, from death, from pains, from defilements, bahuna, does the Tathagata dwell with the mind unrestricted? Just as bahuna, a blue lotus, a red lotus, or a white lotus, born in the water, grown up in the water, rises well above the water, and remains unsmeared by water. Even so, bahuna, does the Tathagata dwell, detached, disengaged, and released from these ten things with the mind unrestricted? This discourse in particular highlights the transcendence of the Tathagata, though he seems to take in worldly objects through the senses. Even the release from the five aggregates is affirmed. We might wonder why the Tathagata is said to be free from birth, decay and death, since as we know, he did grow old and pass away. Birth, decay and death in this context do not refer to some future state either. Here and now, the Tathagata is free from the concepts of birth, decay and death. In the course of our discussion of the term papancha, we had occasion to illustrate how one can be free from such concepts. If concepts of birth, decay and death drive fear into the minds of worldlings, such is not the case with the Tathagata. He is free from such fears and forebodings. He is free from defilements as well. The discourse seems to affirm that the Tathagata dwells detached from all these ten things. It seems, therefore, that the functioning of the Tathagata's sense faculties in his everyday life also should follow a certain extraordinary pattern of detachment and disengagement. In fact, Venerable Sariputta says something to that effect in the Salayatana Sanyutta of the Sanyutta Nikaya. Passati bhagava chakhuna rupam chandarago bhagavato natthi suimutta chitto bhagava. The exalted one sees forms with the eye, but there is no desire or attachment in him. Well freed in mind is the exalted one. We come across a similar statement made by the Brahmin youth Uttara in the Brahmāyusutta of the Majjhima Nikāya after he had closely followed the Buddha for a considerable period to verify the good report of his extraordinary qualities. Rasapatisanvedi khopanaso bhavang gotamo aharang ahareti no rasaragapatisanvedi. Experiencing taste, Master Gotama takes his food but not experiencing any attachment to the taste. It is indeed something marvelous. The implication is that there is such degree of detachment with regard to things experienced by the tongue, even when the senses are taking in their objects. One can understand the difference between the mundane and the supramundane when one reflects on the difference between experiencing taste and experiencing an attachment to taste. Not only with regard to the objects of the five senses, but even with regard to the mind objects, the emancipated one has a certain degree of detachment, since the Arahant has realized that they are not such. He takes in concepts and even speaks in terms of eye and mind, but knows that they are false concepts. As in the case of the child's language, there is a discourse among the nines of the Anguttara Nikaya which seems to assert this fact. It is a discourse preached by Venerable Sariputta to refute a wrong viewpoint taken by a monk named Chandikaputta. Evaṁ sammā vimuttasakho āvuso bhikkhuno bhusācepi chakkhuvinyayā rūpā chakkhusāpāthaṁ āgacchanti nevasa cittaṁ pariyādhyanti amisi katame vasa cittaṁ hoti thitaṁ ānijyappattaṁ bhusācepi sotavinyayā saddha bhusācepi ghānavinyayā gandha bhusācepi jivhāvinyayā rasa bhusācepi kāyavinyayā phuttabha bhusācepi manovinyayā dhamma āpāthaṁ āgacchanti nevasa cittaṁ pariyādhyanti amisi katame vasa cittaṁ hoti thitaṁ ānijyappattaṁ vayaṁ cassānupassati. Friend, in the case of a monk who is fully released, even if many forms cognizable by the eye come within the range of vision, they do not overwhelm his mind. His mind remains unalloyed, steady and unmoved. Even if many sounds cognizable by the ear come within the range of hearing, even if many smells cognizable by the nose, even if many tastes cognizable by the tongue, even if many tangibles cognizable by the body, even if many mind objects cognizable by the mind come within the range of the mind, they do not overwhelm his mind. His mind remains unalloyed, steady and unmoved. He sees its passing away. So here we have the ideal of the emancipated mind. Generally, a person unfamiliar with the nature of a lotus leaf or a lotus petal, on seeing a drop of water on a lotus leaf or a lotus petal, would think that the water drop smears them. Earlier we happened to mention that there is a wide gap between the mundane and the supramundane. Some might think that this refers to a gap in time or space. In fact, it is such a conception that often led to various misinterpretations concerning Nibbana. The supramundane seems so far away from the mundane, so it must be something attainable after death in point of time, or else it should be far, far away in outer space. Such is the impression made in general. But if we go by the simile of the drop of water on the lotus leaf, the distance between the mundane and the supramundane is the same as that between the lotus leaf and the drop of water on it. We are still on the problem of the hither shore and the farther shore. The distinction between the mundane and the supramundane brings us to the question of this shore and the other shore. The Arahant's conception of this shore and the other shore differs from that of the worldling in general. If, for instance, a native of this island goes abroad and settles down there, he might even think of a return to his country as a going abroad. Similarly, as far as the emancipated sage is concerned, if he, having gone to the farther shore, does not come back, one might expect him to think of this world as the farther shore. But it seems the Arahant has no such distinction. A certain Dhammapada verse alludes to the fact that he has transcended this dichotomy. Yassa parang aparang va para parang navijyati vitaddarang visangyuttang tamahang bhumi brah. This is a verse we had quoted earlier too in connection with the question of the verbal dichotomy. Yassa parang aparang va para parang navijyati. To whom there is neither a farther shore nor a hither shore, nor both. That is to say, he has no discrimination between the two. Vitaddarang visangyuttam tamaham bhumi brahmanam. Who is free from pangs of sorrow and entanglements, him I call a Brahman. This means that the Arahant is free from the verbal dichotomy which is of relevance to the worldling. Once gone beyond, the emancipated one has no more use of these concepts. This is where the Buddha's dictum in the raft simile of the Aladhattupama Sutta becomes meaningful. Even the concepts of a this shore and a farther shore are useful only for the purpose of crossing over. If, for instance, the Arahant, having gone beyond, were to think, "Ah, this is my land," that would be some sort of a grasping. Then there will be an identification, tammeta, not a non-identification, atammeta. As we had mentioned earlier, there is a strange quality called atammeta associated with an Arahant in connection with the simile of a man who picked up a gem. We have already stated the ordinary norm that prevails in the world. If we possess something, we are possessed by it. If we grasp something, we are caught by it. This is the moral behind the parable of the gem. It is this conviction which prompts the Arahant not to grasp even the farther shore, though he may stand there. This shore and the other shore are concepts which have a practical value to those who are still on this side. As it is stated in the Aladhattupama Sutta, since there is no boat or bridge to cross over, one has to improvise a raft by putting together grass, twigs, branches, and leaves found on this shore. But after crossing over with its help, he does not carry it with him on his shoulder. Even so, monks, have I preached to you a dhamma that is comparable to a raft which is for crossing over and not for grasping? Well, knowing the dhamma to be comparable to a raft, you should abandon even the good things, more so the bad things. One might think that the Arahant is in the sensuous realm, when, for instance, he partakes of food, but that is not so. Though he attains to the realms of form and formless realms, he does not belong there. He has the ability to attain to those levels of concentration, but he does not grasp them egoistically. True to that norm of atammayata or non-identification, this indeed is something extraordinary. Views and opinions about language, dogmatically entertained by the worldlings, lose their attraction for him. This fact is clearly illustrated for us by the Uraga Sutta of the Suttanipata, the significance of which we have already stressed. We happen to mention that there is a refrain running through all the 17 verses making up that discourse. The refrain concerns the worn-out skin of a snake. The last two lines in each verse forming the refrain are So bhikkhu jahati oraparam urago jinnamiva tachang puranam. That monk forsakes the hither and the thither, even as the snake its skin that doth wither. The term Orapara is highly significant in this context. Orang means this shore, and Parang is the farther shore. The monk, it seems, gives up not only this shore, but the other shore as well, even as the snake sloughs off its worn-out skin. That skin has served its purpose, but now it is redundant, so it is sloughed off. Let us now take up one more verse from the Uruga Sutta, which has the same refrain, because of its relevance to the understanding of the term papancha. The transcendence of relativity involves freedom from the duality in worldly concepts such as good and evil. The concept of a farther shore stands relative to the concept of a hither shore. The point of these discourses is to indicate that there is a freedom from worldly conceptual proliferations based on duality and relativity. The verse we propose to bring up is Yo nachasari na pachasari sabbang achagama imang papancham so bhikkhu jati oraparang urago jinnamiva tachang puran. Who neither overreaches himself nor lags behind and has gone beyond all this proliferation. That monk forsakes the hither and the thither, even as the snake its love, that death hither. This verse is particularly significant in that it brings out some points of interest. The overreaching and lagging behind is an allusion to the verbal dichotomy. In the context of views, for instance, annihilationism is an overreaching and eternalism is a lagging behind. We may give another illustration easier to understand. Speculation about the future is an overreaching and repentance over the past is a lagging behind. To transcend both these tendencies is to get beyond proliferation. Sabbang achagama imam papancha. When a bank note is invalidated, cravings, conceits and views bound with it go down. Concepts current in the world, like banknotes in transaction, are reckoned as valid so long as cravings, conceits and views bound with them are there. They are no longer valid when these are gone. We have defined papancha with reference to cravings, conceits and views. Commentaries also speak of tanha papancha, ditti papancha and mana papancha. By doing away with cravings, conceits and views, one goes beyond all papancha. The term oraparang too has many connotations. It stands for the duality implicit in such usages as the internal and the external, one's own and another's, as well as this shore and the farther shore. It is compared here to the worn-out skin of the snake. It is worn out by transcending the duality characteristic of linguistic usage through wisdom. Why the Buddha first hesitated to teach this Dhamma was the difficulty of making the world understand it. Perhaps it was the conviction that the world could easily be misled by those limitations in the linguistic medium. We make these few observations in order to draw attention to the relativity underlying such terms as this shore and the other shore, and to show how Nibbana transcends even that dichotomy. In this connection, we may take up for comment a highly controversial sutta in the Itiguttaka, which deals with the two aspects of Nibbana known as Saupadishesa Nibbana Dhatu and Anupadishesa Nibbana Dhatu. We propose to quote the entire sutta so as to give a fuller treatment to the subject. Vuttang hetang bhagavata vuttang arahata ti me sutang dvema bhikkave nibbana dhatyo katama dve saupadishesa cha nibbana dhatu anupadishesa cha nibbana dhatu katama cha bhikkave saupadishesa nibbana dhatu ita bhikkave bhikkhu arahang hoti khinasabu buchitava katagaraniyo ohita bharo anuppatta sadatto parikkhina bhava sanyojano සම්මදඤ්ඤා විමුක්තෝ පස්ස තිට්ඨං තේව පංචේන්ද්‍රයානි යේසං අවිඝාතත්තා මනාපා මනාපං පච්චනුභෝති සුඛ දුක්ඛං පච්චංවේදේති තස්ස යෝ රාගඛයෝ දෝසඛයෝ මොහඛයෝ අයං මුච්චති භික්ඛවේ සෝපාදිශේසා නිබ්බාණ ධාතු කතමාච භික්ඛවේ අනුපාදිශේසා නිබ්බාණ ධාතු ඉද භික්ඛවේ භික්ඛු අරහං හෝති කීනාසව උපසිතවා කතකරණීයෝ ඕහිත භාරෝ අනුපත්ත සදත්තෝ පරික්ඛීන භවසඤ්ඤෝජනෝ සම්මදඤ්ඤා විමුක්තෝ තස්ස ඉදේව සබ්බ වේදිතානි අනභිනන්තිතානි සීති භවිස්සanti අයං මුච්චති භික්ඛවේ අනුපාදිශේසා නිබ්බාණ ධාතු ඒතමත්තං භගවා වෝච තත්ථේතං ඉති මුච්චති දුවේ ඉමා චක්ඛුමතා පකාසිතා නිබ්බාණ ධාතු අනිසිතේන තාදිනා ඒකායි ධාතු ඉද දෙට්ට ධම්මිකා සෝපාදිශේසා භවනිත්‍ති සංඛයා අනුපාදිශේසා පන සම්පරායිකා යම්හි නිරුජ්ජಂತಿ භවානි සබ්බසෝ ඊයේත ධඤ්ඤාය පදං අසංඛතං දුනුත් චිත්තා භවනිත්‍ති සංඛයා තේ ධම්මසාරාදිගමා ඛෛරතා පාංසුතේ සබ්බ භවානි තාදි අයම්පි අත්ථෝ උත්තෝ භගවතා ඉති මේ සුත්. This was said by the exalted one, said by the worthy one. So have I heard. Monks, there are these two Nibbana elements. Which two? The Nibbana element with residual clinging and the Nibbana element without residual clinging. And what is the Nibbana element with residual clinging? Herein, monks, a monk is an arahant with influxes extinct, one who has lived the holy life to the full, done what is to be done, laid down the burden, freed one's God, fully destroyed the fetters of existence, and released with full understanding. His five sense faculties still remain, and due to the fact that they are not destroyed, he experiences likes and dislikes and pleasures and pains. That extirpation of lust, hate and delusion in him, that monk is known as the Nibbana element with residual clinging. And what monks is the Nibbana element without residual clinging? Herein, monks, a monk is an arahant with influxes extinct, one who has lived a holy life to the full, done what is to be done, laid down the burden, freed one's wound, fully destroyed the fetters of existence, and released with full understanding. In him, here itself, all what is felt will cool off, not being delighted in. This month is the Nibbana element without residual clinging. To this effect, the Exalted One spoke, and this is the gist handed down as thus said. These two Nibbana elements have been made known by the one with vision, unattached and such. Of relevance to the here and now is one element, with residual clinging, yet with tentacles to becoming snap. But then that element without residual clinging is of relevance to the hereafter, for in it surcease all forms of becoming. They that comprehend fully this state unprepared, released in mind with tentacles to becoming snap, on winning to the essence of Dhamma, they take delight in seeing to an end of it all. So give up they all forms of becoming, steadfastly such like as they are. The standard phrase summing up the qualification of an arahant occurs in full in the definition of Saupadishesa Nibbana Dhatu. The distinctive feature of this Nibbana element is brought out in the statement that the arahant's five sense faculties are still intact, owing to which he experiences likes and dislikes and pleasure and pain. However, to the extent that lust, hate and delusion are extinct in him, it is called the Nibbana element with residual clinging. In the definition of the Nibbana element without residual clinging, the same standard phrase recurs, while its distinctive feature is summed up in just one sentence. Tassa idheva sabbavedaitani anabhinanditani siti bhavissanti. In him, here itself, all what is felt will cool off, not being delighted in. It may be noted that the verb is in the future tense, and apart from this cooling off, there is no guarantee of a world beyond, as an asankhata dhatu or unprepared element with no sun, moon or stars in it. The two verses that follow purport to give the summary of the prose passage. Here it is clearly stated that out of the two Nibbana elements, as they are called, the former pertains to the here and now, Ditta Dhammika, while the latter refers to what comes after death, Samparayika. The Nibbana element with residual clinging, Saupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu, has as its redeeming feature the assurance that the tentacular craving for becoming is cut off, despite its exposure to likes and dislikes, pleasures and pains, common to the field of the five senses. As for the Nibbana element without residual clinging, it is definitely stated that in it all forms of existence come to cease. The reason for it is none other than the crucial fact stated in that single sentence, namely the cooling off of all what is felt as an inevitable consequence of not being delighted in anabhinanditani. Why do they not take delight in what is felt at the moment of passing away? They take delight in something else, and that is the very destruction of all what is felt, a foretaste of which they have already experienced in their attainment to that unshakable deliverance of the mind, which is the very pith and essence of the Dhamma, Dhamma Sara. As stated in the Mahasaropama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, the pith of the Dhamma is that deliverance of the mind. And to take delight in the ending of all feelings, Khayarata, is to revert to the Arhat Phala Samadhi, with which the Arahant is already familiar. That is how those such-like ones abandon all forms of existence. Pahansute sabba bhavan tadi. Let us now try to sort out the problems that are likely to be raised in connection with the interpretation we have given. First and foremost, the two terms Ditta Dhammika and Samparayika have to be explained. A lot of confusion has arisen due to a misunderstanding of the meaning of these two terms in this particular context. The usual commentarial exegesis on the term Ditta Dhammika amounts to this: Imasmi attabhave bhava vattamana, in this very life, that is, in the present. It seems all right. But then for Samparayika, the commentary has the following comment: Samparayeti khandabhedato parabhavi. Samparaya means after the breaking up of the aggregates. The implication is that it refers to the Arahant's after death state. Are we then to conclude that the Arahant gets half of his Nibbana here and the other half hereafter? The terms Ditta Dhammika and Samparayika, understood in their ordinary sense, would point to such a conclusion. But let us not forget that the most distinctive quality of this Dhamma is associated with the highly significant phrase Ditteva Dhamme, in this very life. It is also conveyed by the expression Sandittham Akalika, here and now and timeless. The goal of endeavor indicated by this Dhamma is one that could be fully realized here and now in this very life. It is not a piecemeal affair. Granting all that, do we find here something contrary to it conveyed by the two terms Ditta Dhammika and Samparayika? How can we reconcile these two positions? In the context of Kamma, the meaning of the two terms in question can easily be understood. For instance, that category of Kamma known as Ditta Dhamma Vedaniya refers to those actions which produce their results here and now. Samparayika pertains to what comes after death, as for instance in the phrase Samparayicha Duggati, an evil born after death, Machari Sutta Devata Samyutta. In the context of Kamma, it is clear enough then that the two terms refer to what is experienced in this world and to what comes after death, respectively. Are we justified in applying the same criterion when it comes to the so-called two elements of Nibbana? Do the Arahants experience some part of Nibbana here and the rest hereafter? At this point, we have to admit that the term Ditta Dhammika is associated with Saupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu, while the term Samparayika is taken over to refer to Anupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu. However, the fact that Nibbana is explicitly defined elsewhere as the cessation of existence, Bhavanirodho Nibbana, must not be forgotten. If Nibbana is the cessation of existence, there is nothing left for the Arahant to experience hereafter. Nibbana is purely the realization of the cessation of existence or the end of the process of becoming. So there is absolutely no question of a hereafter for the Arahant. By way of clarification, we have to revert to the primary sense of the term Nibbana. We have made it sufficiently clear that Nibbana means extinction or extinguishment as of a fire. All the commentarial jargon equating vana to tanha is utterly irrelevant. If the idea of an extinguishment of a fire is brought in, the whole problem is solved. Think of a blazing fire. If no more firewood is added to it, the flames would subside and the embers would go on smoldering before turning into ashes. This is the norm. Now this is not an analogy we are superimposing on the Dhamma. It is only an echo of a canonical simile picked up from the Naga Sutta of the Anguttara Nikaya. The relevant verse we are quoting recurs in the Udai Theragatha as well. Mahagini Pajjalito Anaharopa Sammati Angaresu cha santesu nibbutoti pauchati. As a huge blazing fire with no more firewood added goes down to reach a state of calm, embers smoldering as they are could be reckoned so long as they last as almost extinguished. Though we opted to render the verse this way, there is a variant reading which could lead to a different interpretation. As so often happens in the case of deep suttas, here too the correct reading is not easily determined. Instead of the phrase angaresu cha santesu attested as it is, many editions go for the variant reading sankharesu upasantesu. If that reading is adopted, the verse would have to be rendered as follows. A huge blazing fire with no more firewood added goes down to reach a state of calm. When sankhara has calmed down, one is called extinguished. It may be pointed out that this variant reading does not accord with the imagery of the fire presented by the first two lines of the verse. It is probably a scribe's error that has come down due to the rhythmic similarity between the two phrases angaresu cha santesu and sankharesu upasantesu. Between the reciter and the scribe, phrases that have a similar ring and rhythm could sometimes bring about a textual corruption. Be that as it may, we have opted for the reading angaresu cha santesu because it makes more sense. From the particular context in which the verse occurs, it seems that this imagery of the fire is a restatement of the image of the lotus unsmeared by water. Though the embers are still smoldering to the extent that they are no longer hungering for more fuel, and are not emitting flames, they may as well be reckoned as extinguished. We can draw a parallel between this statement and the definition of Saupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu already quoted. As a full-fledged Arahant, he still experiences likes and dislikes and pleasures and pains, owing to the fact that his five sense faculties are intact. The assertion made by the phrase beginning with tassa tittanteva panchindriyani yesam avighatatta, his five senses do exist, owing to the non-destruction of which, etc., rather apologetically brings out the limitations of the living Arahant. It is reminiscent of those smoldering embers in the imagery of the Naga Sutra. However, in so far as flames of lust, hate and delusion are quenched in him, it comes to be called Saupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu, even as in the case of those smoldering embers. Craving is aptly called Bhavanetti in the sense that it leads to becoming by catching hold of more and more fuel in the form of Upadana. When it is under control, the functioning of the sense faculties do not entail further rebirth. The inevitable residual clinging in the living Arahant does not precipitate a fresh existence. This gives us a clue to the understanding of the term Anupadisesa. The element upadhi in this term is rather ambiguous. In the Satipatthana Sutta, for instance, it is used as the criterion to distinguish the anagami, non-returner, from the arhat. In the statement, Tittheva Dhamme Anya Sativa Upadhi Sese Anagamita, either full convincing knowledge of arhanthood here and now, or the state of non-return in the case of residual clinging. But when it comes to the distinction between Saupadhi Sesa and Anupadhi Sesa, the element Upadhi has to be understood in a more radical sense in association with the word Upadhinna. This body, as the product of past karma, is the grasp par excellence, which as an organic combination goes on functioning even in the arahant until his last moment of life. Venerable Sariputta once declared that he neither longed for death nor delighted in life. Nabhikankami marana, nabhinandami jivita. So the embers go on smoldering until they become ashes. It is when the lifespan ends that the embers finally turn to ashes. The popular interpretation of the term Anupadhisesa Nibbana Dhatu leaves room for some absolutist conception of an Asankhata Dhatu, unprepared element, as the destiny of the Arahant. After his Parinibbana, he is supposed to enter this particular Nibbana Dhatu. But here in this discourse, it is explained in just one sentence. Tassa idheva bhikkave sabba vedaitani anabhinanditani siti bhavisanti. In the case of him, that is the arhat, O monks, all what is felt, not having been delighted in, will cool off here itself. This cooling off happens just before death, without igniting another spark of life. When Mara comes to grab and seize, the arahant lets go. The pain of death with which Mara teases his hapless victim and lures him into another existence becomes ineffective in the case of the arahant. As he has already gone through the supramundane experience of deathlessness in the arahatta phala samadhi, death loses its sting when at last it comes. The influx-free deliverance of the mind and the influx-free deliverance through wisdom enable him to cool down all feelings in a way that baffles Mara. So the arahant lets go of his body, experiencing ambrosial deathlessness. As in the case of Venerable Dabbamallaputta, he would sometimes cremate his own body without leaving any ashes. Outwardly, it might appear as an act of self-immolation, which indeed is painful. But this is not so. Using his jhanic powers, he simply employs the internal fire element to cremate the body he has already discarded. This then is the Buddha's extraordinary solution to the problem of overcoming death, a solution that completely outwits Mara.
Dear listeners, it is our sincere wish to make these sermons accessible free of charge to all who like to listen to them, because the gift of the Dhamma excels all other gifts. We therefore encourage you to copy these sermons and share them with others, but kindly note that they should not be reproduced for sale. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you.